there, we'll look.
I remember when my college buddy covered that in his college Bible class about the life of calling out a bear to give a kid. It was real difficult when I bring him for a while. God. That never before. Yelling at four people in here who didn't want to go to translation and put a burden on them, but that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, you guys do that all the time. Well, you know, you got to be tougher to be a Hebrew student. You've been seasoned veterans of this. Yeah, we had most of those guys didn't realize that the Hebrew students had to do that all the time. I hadn't thought about that. Well, tribulation worketh patience. Yeah, it really is good. You know, it's actually better for you to have to do this more. The more you have to read it out loud and so forth, the better it's going to be for you later on. At the U, when I took Hebrew, that was one good thing, about the only good thing I got out of it, you know. But the professor made us do that every day, and you could count on having to read some and out loud, and it forces you to do some things your mind would be too lazy otherwise. I find myself, you know, I give it to you. I'd like to do more myself, you know, reading out loud. I don't have too much opportunity in a pressure environment. That's the best kind of situation. Well, we're looking at lesson 54. We have a few more exercises to do there, and then we'll get into 55, last one in the book. And I believe my marker indicates that we left off about number 12 on part B. And I don't know if we did that one yet or not. I think we did number 8. These are all kind of fun because they're something odd about almost all of them. And let me see. I don't think we did 12.
No.
Okay. So who wants to volunteer? Eric, take your first. And okay. Or just Wayak Othi. Just Wayak. It's from Hikka, the Hithiel Justive form. So, and in the Justive, we're just assuming it's Justive because they'll use a Justive in a while consecutive if they can. Since it's a while consecutive form, the Justive form doesn't work, you know, when you put a suffix on, but when you don't, then you do. So, Wayak. Wayak Othi. And the spelling would be Waw with Pathak, Yod with Dagation Pathak, Kaf with Shua. The Hifil Jussi from Hikka, which is a Hifil from a one nun. So we had a one nun, three hey, Hifil Jussi form. Is there a Dagation the Kaf on that one? On the end, I guess, yeah, there probably is. I just didn't put it in. Well, let's see, it's a final now. Yeah, it's a final now, but there, see.
I wonder how you write.
You know, I got a good point there. Yeah, it's double because of the nun being assimilated. Yeah, that's a good point. I think I looked it up though. Probably I didn't. It didn't have. Well, you can see them with three dots sometimes.
A cough.
Yeah.
Final cough.
But I'm wondering here if this doubling is because of the nun. You almost have to have it in there, otherwise that nun isn't showing up. I thought I'd looked it up, and I don't have one down here, but I think you're right that it should be there. Okay, Wayak could be Waw with Pathak, Yod with Dagation Pathak, and final Kaf with Shua. But the question we're asking is whether there should be also a Dagation there, and it looks like there should. The question is that a Dagesh Vorte or a Leni? And originally it got there because of the nun getting assimilated, which would make it a forte. But when you put it at the end of a word like that, there's some debate here in my mind as to whether that's going to still hold. Yeah, we better Anything with a kaf in a jussive back there. If you look back at the three hey jussives, see how the ones. Well, no, I guess we need it with a one nun. We need a one nun to find out if the dagesh of the nun. We need something that has a kaf in the second position in three hey, and it's also got a one nun. So we may be having to look for this verb itself. Let's see, the one nun chapter here. We'll see if we can find something. Okay, that's what I had. About page 227?
Yeah, right in the middle column, bottom of Joseph.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, it sure does. And it's going to have to do the same here. So it was right the way I had it to start with. But it's just because the thing, well, you know, that's a reasonable question. I probably just looked it up or something and put it down here and didn't think about it that much. But I guess you just have to consider the justice of shortening that too. You know, shortening, lopping off the extra. What happened there? Somebody in shock.
Yeah,
that's funny. Yeah. Okay, what would the translation of this be? Yeah, and he killed me. It's a little bit hard to say that, but, or you could make it he smote or struck me too. The word can also mean to smite or strike. It'll be a little bit more. Or you know, somebody in the resurrection could say this, I suppose. Okay. Yeah. Number 15, Price. Okay, yes. Yitishu Othaka. Yitishu Othaka. And Yitishu would be spelled Yod with Hirik, Taith with Dagesh, and Shawa. And then Sheen with Shirik.
Well, I spelled that right.
Get it all right. Great. Okay, and what would the meaning be?
They abandoned you.
Okay, or yeah, this is an imperfect also.
They
will.
Will abandon.
Yeah, they will abandon you. Okay, they will abandon you, or they will forsake you. Yeah. Okay, and any questions on this one? It's a little tamer than some of the others.
Is that still imperfect? Is it still a default?
It's a one nun. That's where the dagesh is coming from. It's just a call. Yeah, we had that verb in this lesson too, didn't we? Vocab.
Yeah,
Natash. Okay. Part C, number one. And who's next, Doug? This one you have to. Well, for exercise, go ahead and read, since we don't have any reading this time, go ahead and read it the way it is, and then give me what you have by reducing the nominal object to a pronominal one. Mm-hmm. Right, he shall give to us rain. Okay. He shall give us rain, or give to us rain. And so we want to say now he will give it to us.
Okay.
Referring to the rain. Okay. Okay, yeah. Yitanehu, you probably, since it's a dagesh there, you probably have a vocal schwa. But yeah, Yitanehu. Okay, or Yitanenu. Right, there's two options for the third person masculine singular. So Yitanenu or Yitanehu. And then Lanu you'd put there also because of to us. Yitanenu, Lanu, or Yitanehu, Lanu, or Yitanenu, Lanu. And I'll spell it both ways here. If you had Yitanehu, it would be Yod with Hirik, Tau with Dagesh and Shawa, Nun with Seri, Hey, Shurek. Or the other option would be Yit and Nenu would be Yod with Hirik, Tau with Dagesh and Shua, Nun with Segol, Nun with Dagesh and Shirek. Yit and Nenu. Okay. And of course, you're always going to have for it, it's either going to be masculine or feminine, depending on what the noun was. So since rain is masculine, it's him. All right, number four. Oh, yes. Well, when you have the, well, yeah, the reason for, in the first place, matar was anarthrous, so you don't need the object marker there. And then when you put it as a pronominal suffix, it's kind of including the object marker in a way. Because you're making something definite by virtue of putting a suffix on it. And see, before we split things off, you could say otho, you know, or you could, you know, which has s plus the marker plus the suffix on it, or put the suffix on, which automatically makes the s. You know, think of an s automatically included, perhaps. Since anytime you're making something a pronoun, you're going to make it a definite concept. A little bit. Yeah, you're losing some precision because, you know, if you put the nominal object, you can say he will give us rain or he will give us the rain, either one. But if you say he will give it to us, the it kind of loses that distinction. See what I'm saying? You know, it's you can't say the it versus it. Well, yeah, I know it. You could consider it that way, yeah. You gained some definiteness, I suppose. But the definiteness you gained was gained because of the... it's kind of a grammatical thing, because you made it a pronoun. And you see, when you make something into a pronoun, you are automatically making it definite because you're saying that my context is sufficient to specify it. And it may be a different kind of definiteness, but still a definiteness. Then you're losing that subtle distinction that you could have in with a noun. Okay. Number four, then, Peter. Go ahead and read it. Okay.
He's the wicked.
Mm-hmm. Or you could make this, na'eitz would be an imperative. Spurn the
evil.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Spurn the evil ones or something, because it's plural there. So you probably have the evil ones. Spurn the evil ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you have? You probably looked at it as a stative verb pattern, didn't you?
Well, I was wondering. I thought it was just called.
Yeah, it's...
It's
the PL and imperative here.
So you're going to have a past on coming first.
Mm-hmm.
And a dot you can't
double. Yeah, you probably would have had a comma from the first before. Well, we'd have to double check that one. Somebody looked it up, though. It's definitely a peel.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, okay. Sometimes you do need to look them up because there's too many. Okay. So the normally form is nit eight and.
Oh, I'm looking under. Oh, wait, there it is.
Yeah. So look back at the chapter and. Okay, and then it's because it's a guttural. But where's the what page has the paradigm for the PL?
Well, the previous page has the imperative.
Okay.
The PL is in every chapter with the imperfect.
Yeah. Okay, two guttural PL, perfect imperative. Okay, that's got two pathoks in that one.
The suffix would be.
Two guttural. Okay. Yeah, your pattern is just like Ba'er on page 195. See section 149, PL verb stems and inflection. The third category down in that paradigm is your two guttural. They give Ba'er. That's analogous to what we have here. And then you get, Pathak Seri for the imperative. And then there's two ways that, two paradigms for that. Some of them get a comet's seri. And this one's got an aleph, but it gets a pathak anyway. Well, so be it. It is hard to remember. These imperatives, when they're short, they're hard to remember which patterns they are. So, but this is imperative. Okay?
So we have not asam.
Right. Na'at same. Na'at same. Tzeri name.
Oh, because it's an imperative.
Right. Because it's going to take the imperfect. But the imperative ones take the same kind of suffix system that the imperfects do. So you get the Tzeri name. So Na'at same would be Nun with Pathak, Aleph with Chatef Pathak, Tzade with Tzeri and Mame. Okay. So that's analogous to, well, probably not analogous to anything there. The reason you get the Chatef Pathak is because it would have gone to Shua. So Shalak, I guess, is about the close. Well, Bakish. It's a little bit like that, except that the... Okay. Number 8, back to John. Under part C.
Ba'er F. Ari.
That's from Ir, city. It's way from way back.
Oh.
It's got the suffix. It's plural and a suffix on it. So it was an irregular plural. And remember, it was Arim, and then you get Ra.
Burn your cities.
Yeah, burn their cities.
Burn
their cities. So it's an imperative. Burn their cities.
So it would be probably... Bahrain.
Yes. Yeah, to say burn them, referring to the cities, would be Bahrain. Yeah, cities is feminine. Good. So Bahrain with a nun at the end. Spelling would be Beth with Dagesh and Pathak, Ayin with Chatef Pathak, Resh with Tzeri, and then nun. Because cities is feminine. Good. Real good. Okay. Any questions on that? The form is just the same as before, though the pattern, vowel pattern, is the same as number 4. Number 12, Eric.
Asker
Okay.
Mention.
Right. Mention his name or cause his name to be remembered or cause to remember his name. Now we want to say cause it to be remembered or mention it. Referring to name. Okay. Yeah. Did you have a Hirik Yod in there, Hazkurenu or Hazkurehu? Yours, I've got a Hirik Yod in mine. It's a Hifil form, and I think what's happening. Oh, that's a question I have now. The imperative.
Yeah, it
looks like it goes back. I have it down here too, but I'll have to confess I've forgotten about that feature too. See? Yeah. So normally your Hifil loses the Hirik Yod and gets Tzeri in the imperative, but if you look at your page, Bob, page 273, it comes back when you put the suffixes on. So we've got Hashmei there is the imperative for Shamaz, but then Hashmei Dehu, you get the Hirik Yod back.
And Bob, but don't we know it's not a perfect form then? Because it takes the perfect, goes back to the perfect form.
Yeah. It's similar.
And so that tells you that it can't be perfect, and it can't be perfect, it's got to be imperfect. It's got to be imperative.
Yeah.
A lot of information between two dots.
Yeah, without vowel points, you would be stuck. Because, you know, you'd have Hishma. You'd have a different vowel pattern, but it's without vowel points, you wouldn't be able to tell. Okay, that's what they rely on context, I suppose, modern Hebrew. All right, the spelling of this one then would be Haz Kirehu or Haz Ki, the Husky Renu. And Husky Rehu would be Hay with Pathak, Zion with Shawa, Kaf with Dalgation, Hirik Yoz, Resh with Tseri, and then Hay and Shurek. And then if you had Enu, well, just the same beginning, you just put Enu instead of Ehu in the end. And that'd be under the Resh, you'd have a Segol then, and then a Nun with Dalgation, Shurek. Okay, and the last one, number 15, Price. Okay.
Plant the olive trees.
Plant the olive trees. Yeah, there's no possessive on that one. Okay, so plant them would be what? Nita aim. Again, it's that serimim suffix for the imperative, which is the same as the imperfect. So nita aim, and that would be spelled nun with shawa. Taith with comets, Ayin with Sari and Maim, Nita'im. Okay, and what happens there too, you get a lengthening. Yeah, it's just like Shema there, the third one down in your call paradigm on page 193. You get the lengthening to a comets before those endings. So that's kind of a surprise. And like I said, I can't tell you why. It just says. Okay, any other questions or observations? All right. That brings us to lesson 55. This isn't really that difficult a one in itself, but it's kind of long.
Yeah, all right.
When we get beyond this, do you have a set idea of scriptures you're going to read, or can we possibly get some input?
Yeah, I want to give you some input. I'm going to take some requests, you know. But we want to start some in Genesis, some simple things. We want to start in some areas where we're familiar, where you're already familiar with what it means. So it gives you a little bit, a few more cues. I mean, if we plunge right in the middle of some historical book someplace, and Well, we can. Let me put it this way. I'll take requests, and I want to get a sampling of a lot of types of Hebrew. So we do want to get some things in Daniel. We want to get some things in Ezekiel. Some hard stuff as well as some easy stuff. Some things in historical books, some things in Psalms, some things in Proverbs, and we'll just take shorter sections in many of those different areas to get a range. So if you have a particular text or something that you'd like, all of you think of it, we'll give you each one an option or something, your favorite scriptures in Hebrew, that'd be fine, as long as we get a range of it. Oh yeah, that'd be fine too. I don't want to take a lot of time getting into theological issues, but as long as they're grammatically based, I do like to do that to some extent, because I want you to get a taste in a classroom situation of what you're going to be wrestling with in the future, and the reason why you took Hebrew. So, after all of this effort, finally getting through the book, yeah, now you're going to be able to get taste some of the fruit of it, and that's what we really want. Okay, and what we'll do is... from after we're done with this chapter, just bring a text along, and I'm not going to be quite as strict on it in this class as I am in the other, as far as having English, beside you or whatever. I'm not too worried about that. It's probably best if you don't, just try to do it from Hebrew, and then have the other source there so you can be looking when it's not your turn or something, just to kind of get the gist of what's going on, maybe. And we'll maybe want to have somebody manning an analytical, so that we can get quick reference to things, because we don't have a nice parsing guide, that I could have up here to have reference to get things quickly. Yeah, maybe I'll probably have Jay Green or something, just to have, I'll be looking at that, so we've got an interlinear to look at, and then if something comes up that's sticky or something, we can look it up. Sometimes even with that, they'll give you what it is, but you still don't know what that root verb was, why it's got such a weird form or something, and we may want to look them up.
It gives you that one nice, one volume that
you Yeah, that would be nice, too. Yeah. I have to carry enough books to school. I think it was George Boker was wondering yesterday whether I should have a little cart or something, or hire a Chinese coolie. Yeah, I know, I'm going to have to get one like that, one of the... Yeah. One thing about mine is it does give a little bit. You can jam more stuff in it, but the poor thing, it's really on its last legs. Had it repaired already and still needs repair. Okay, lesson 55 then. Conditional sentences. Now, the tricky part of this is not so much that there's anything, any new forms or anything to worry about. Don't have to worry about that, fortunately. The tricky thing is that the cues or the keys to these things are determined by context, and they're kind of subtle. So you have to be following narrative to see these things. You know, it's just like our well consecutive series situations. And in Greek, we had a lot of, you know, key words that would mark out hypotheticals. Well, we do have im and hen and key and some words like that in Hebrew that help us too, but there are oftentimes none of those words are used, and you're having to pick it up just from context. Once you get a feeling for it, though, and as you flow with translations and are aware of how they're doing it, then you can usually pick them out without too much trouble. So let's plunge into this in section 196, conditional sentences. Any two clauses, the first of which states a real or hypothetical condition, and the second of which states a real or hypothetical consequence thereof, may be taken as a conditional sentence. So conditional sentences are if-then type of sentences. If this, then this. The first one is the condition, and the second one is the consequence of it. And they may be real or hypothetical. In other words, it may be a real situation. If he does this, then this is going to happen. It's a very straightforward, predictable situation. Or it may be a hypothetical situation where, a real one might be better to put in the past tense. If he had done this, then this would not have happened, something like that. But the hypothetical might be more in the realm of if this might happen, then this might happen. And neither one of them are events that took place or have taken place, but both are considered in the realm of hypothesis. And we've seen the same kind of thing in the Greek class with the type A, B, and C, as Getches categorized them, various types of conditionals, and some more remote than others, some dealing more with assumed contrary to fact situations. Hebrew doesn't have quite that precision, of course, but this is the area that we're discussing now. Conditional clauses. How do you say if-then type clauses in Hebrew? Now, because conditional sentences entail a logical and usually temporal sequence, they form a natural subgroup related to the narrative sequences. Well, follow the meaning of that statement since? And maybe you don't. Maybe I better talk about it. Remember our narrative sequences that we had before. In a narrative sequence, what you're doing is describing a series of events that follow one upon another. So there's a temporal consecution, that is. One event follows the other in time. Well, that's somewhat analogous to logic. In logic, one thing follows another. Not necessarily in time, but usually in time also. Usually you think of the conclusion after you thought of the premises. So because of the fact that conditional sentences are kind of that way, you have something and then something else follows from that, either in time, you know, if he does this, then the next thing that will happen is that. There will be a temporal relationship there. Cause and effect type of relationships you almost always involve a time type of thing. You seldom have an effect before you have the cause, you see. So you've got a time sequence, and then you may have a logical sequence also that may not necessarily involve time, but logically there's a connection. That means that what we're dealing with here is somewhat similar to the kind of idea we had with narrative sequence, where we had things in order. So we can consider this a subset of that narrative sequences, a subgroup related to the narrative sequences. Conditional sentences in Hebrew may be virtually unmarked. The translation of certain sets of clauses in a regular future narrative sequence often requires a conditional sentence in English. Okay, so if you've got a future narrative sequence, this is oftentimes seen in Hebrew, where you're talking about things that are going to happen in the future and one's going to follow from another. You'll often see those translated by a conditional clause in English. It'll fit better. And although I think many times you can get by just translating it without a condition and take the condition implied, No, he will do this, and then he will do this, and then he will do this, and you can almost get that sense. But here's some examples. Wa'azav et aviu wa'met. And if he leaves his father, he will die. Referring to his father now. This is from Genesis 44, when they're worried about Benjamin leaving Jacob to go to see Joseph. Now, literally, though, it would be, and he leaves his father and he dies. And you can see, sometimes in English, if we really want to stress something, you know, he does this and this happens, you know, and we can say it without even using the conditionals, but we're implying a condition. He does this and this happens. And you see, depending on the context, we might take those as just two completely independent statements. He does this and he does this, and not draw any conclusion between them, a connection between them. But if it's flowing a certain way, and if it's in a certain context, and especially English with certain intonation patterns, we may be able to state the same words and get a conditional out of it. So he's saying, in this context, he's saying, and he leaves his father and he dies. And how are we to understand that? Well, from the context, it's quite clear that what he's saying is if he leaves his father, the father will die. And so there's going to be a cause and effect relationship that's involved. Another example here. Oh, I wanted to point out something here, too. You notice in this wa-meth at the end there? You notice anything peculiar about the conjunction there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
it should be
umeth. It should be umeth because it's a labial there. And all I can say is, Jesenius on page 306 in part G, he's got a section on this. Now, Lambden just stuck this in here and he didn't make any note about it. And as far as I know, Lambden hasn't mentioned anything about it. But immediately before the tone syllable, the conjunction frequently takes comments. So you may see this more often than you think. And if you're wondering why, just immediately before the tone syllable, the conjunction frequently takes comments, but usually at the end of a sentence or clause. So it's probably related to the pausal idea.
What's the tone syllable?
Well, it's the one that takes the stress.
Oh,
in other words, the emphasize. In mate, there's only one syllable, so that's the tone syllable.
Now, Gesenius, what?
No. Okay, the source?
Yeah.
Gesenius, page 306, of his grammar, Gesenius grammar. Page 306, not the lexicon, but the grammar. Page 306, part G, discusses it. So, I don't know that Lambden has a note on this anyplace. Mm-hmm.
So he's not saying in here that wa in no way gives the idea of, the conjunction wa gives no idea of, yes,
this is
great, this is great.
Right. What he's saying is that it's the structural relationship in the context, in the series relationship that's giving the if. It's not the word conjunction wa itself. That's just and. But it's the way that the two phrases are related to each other in the sequence that's giving that. So it's purely the sequential structure that's giving you the conditional here. Now, there are ways to say if in Hebrew. Of course, we've seen im and so forth. We'll get to that in the next page. So there are ways to do that to remove any ambiguity. But I think sometimes what you're seeing, and it'd be worth a study of this, but in both of these examples, you're talking, it's kind of an emotional tension back situation. You know, there's a kind of a trauma involved in the people to an extent who are making these utterances, and that can account for maybe the abruptness and the, you know, when you say things abruptly, there's a little bit more power to them, so forth. Now, I don't know if that analysis would hold up, you know, all the way through. Yeah, it says, and if Saul hears about it, he will kill me. Oh, down, further down. Yeah. Yeah, that's a little bit different situation. Right. And there's no words for if there either. Although the whole setting of giving a series of commandments may give you enough to be able to strip it down a little bit too. And the same with the next example, another, it's a commandment. So that he does make a statement here. Well, let me go ahead and read this paragraph while I'm on this. It says, many such occurrences are ambiguous since a non-conditional translation can also be found. So you could also translate it and be justified. In a series of three or more clauses, it is only a matter of the translator's judgment where to end the protasis and to begin the apotasis. Everybody know what protasis and apotasis are? Okay, I better explain that. Yeah, the protasis is if this, and then the apotasis is then this. So in a conditional clause, you're...
Protasis.
Yeah, right. The if part is the protasis.
And the then part is the apostasis. The it is often making a noun or a concept of it, so probably the thing before. But you might want to check the root there and see what that comes from. I didn't look that up. But the pro, of course, pro is before and apo is from.
Yeah.
So you get the idea. This is the first statement, and this is the one that's coming from it. So you know, if you remember something about Greek, you can at least remember the order of those. So if I say, if you study, you will do well. Well, if you study, that would be your protasis, and then you will do well would be the apotasis. Okay, now, he mentions here, after saying that, his statement was, if you've got a series of things, suppose you, in Hebrew, run across a phrase, let's say a three phrases long, and let's suppose if, and if he leaves his father, let's suppose it just says, and he leaves his father, and he goes with you, and he dies. Okay? Now, that could be understood as, if he leaves his father and goes with you, then his father will die. Or it could be understood, if he leaves his father, then he will go with you and die. in other words, the context will have to decide where you're going to draw the line between the protasis and the apotasis. If you just got two clauses and it's pretty clearly conditional, then the first clause is the protasis, the second clause is the apotasis. But if you've got several clauses together, say four of them, you might have be hard pressed to decide where is the protasis and the apotasis going to be bound and or separated, and that can get a little tricky sometimes. You don't see it real often, but you sometimes have to use just some logical judgment according to the context as to what makes sense. Yes.
Well, it seems that this is not marked with an if or with an e.
Right.
That it might, in some sense, be weaker. However, the way it reads is that it actually could be stronger.
I know it.
Because instead of projecting it so much into a subjunctive or a hypothetical mode, it's stating it as raw fact.
Yeah, I know it. Yeah, that's the point. When you state the if, you're stating your condition. When you don't state the if, it's almost as though it's viewing the thing as a fact that has already happened. It's so certain. You know, he leaves his father and he will die, and that's all there is to it. And you can feel that, and that's why this next statement I think fits in here. In poetic, aphoristic, or legal styles, an otherwise unmarked participial protasis is not infrequent. So you're going to see in legal styles where you have laws that are being brought where the context is already sufficient, or in these poetic things. Now, aphoristic, I'm not sure what that term means. Does anybody know here? I didn't look that up. I should have. I don't know if it has something to do with emotional or energetic thing. Oh yeah, maybe emotional then. Yeah, love.
From the word aphor.
I don't know. The context would tell me it's probably having something to do with emotion or something like that. But we'll probably want to check it.
I thought it meant something.
Anybody got it? Is we have an English dictionary here? I'm curious about this. I intended to look that up and I didn't. But it might. Why don't you run over there and just check real quick? I think it's worthwhile because from the examples above, it seems to have something to do with the energy and the emotion of the thing, you know, that you're expressing something as an urgency maybe and a real splankna that's coming forth in the expression.
The more words.
Yeah, right. Right from the bowels.
When I first heard that word, Mark, I told my wife about it. What it meant, I looked it up in the dictionary.
I couldn't find it.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a Greek word. We used to use it around here all the time.
Oh, yeah. We used to use it all the time.
I couldn't figure out why it wasn't in the English dictionary. I mean, he used it like it was.
Yeah. Interesting. Maybe something totally different than we're guessing here. See how good we are at finding out what words mean from context.
A maxim, a precept or principle expressed in few words, a detached sentence containing some important truth.
Okay.
So it's kind of like the proverb.
Like a proverb or something like that. Yeah.
Very succinct.
Mm-hmm. So you're purposely stripping it down to bare minimum. That would explain why, you know, you wouldn't use the ifs and so forth. Okay. Good. So did the other one concur on that? That's the one you need the magnifying glass to read.
Yeah. I've got a magnifying glass in the box.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Oh, good. I'm glad we looked that up.
Now we all know what it's for.
Right. Okay. Learn something. All right. But the bottom line is context is going to have to help you in some of these. Because all for all the structure looks like, it just looks like a consecutive series, most likely, or just some disjointed verbs with conjunctions. Usually they're going to have converted values here, though. So you start off with a perfect, and then you go continue with imperfects is what's happening here. Okay, so it looks like any other normal walk consecutive series, but it doesn't. There is a logical consecution here, and probably in both these cases it's a temporal one too. If Samuel hears about it, he will kill me. See, Wishama Shemuel Laharag. Haragani, and so there's a logical sequence, and there's also a temporal sequence here. He's going to hear first before he does the killing. So literally, and Saul hears about it and he kills me, you know, he will kill me. Yeah. Eric, did you have something else there?
I discovered now I didn't see how that was a participle, but then I discovered what the object was a participle. So, same word that we discussed earlier about the naka.
Oh, okay.
Naka, but it's a Hebrew participle.
Okay. Okay, good. In this example, umake, and so that's a hifil participle in this instance. If a man slays, in the slaying, it's intended to convey that progressive aspect. If a man slays his father or his mother, he shall be put to death. Now, this would be a series still, because as you recall, in this one, we don't even have the wow. We just have, in Mo, you know, you have a disjunctive situation here, because the remember, a non-verb is beginning the next clause. So it isn't really a category of a series even, but you can still get the sense of a consecution that's involved. So a man slays his father or his mother. Oh, excuse me. Okay, that's his and his mother. All right. We still have kind of a disjunction because we don't have the wo there. But a man slays his father and his mother, moth, Yomat, he shall be put to death. Dying, he shall die, you know. So it's quite abrupt and it's quite emphatic. A man slays his father, his mother. Dying, he shall die. Okay. They say he shall be put to death, but pretty loose, I think. Yeah?
I wonder if it's like a lot of questions that it's the intonation that lets you know.
Yeah. Right, I think so. I think the way you would read it, even in Hebrew, you'd probably intone that differently. We don't really know what their intonation patterns were, but I would imagine today, you know, in modern Hebrew, they would have intonation patterns that would break that up. And, of course, in this case, since it's part of a whole situation, a whole context of commands, you're probably not going to have much trouble identifying it as such. Okay. And if a man keeps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, he should be put to death. This is one where you might have a potential problem in splitting the bodices and bodices here, but context and meaning and so forth would probably settle the issue, because you wouldn't be saying if a man kidnaps a man and sells him, then he is found in his hand and he should be put to death. But rather, if he's found in his hand, in other words, he's trying to give the conditions under which a man's going to be put to death. And since you have this phrase, you should be put to death many times already, you're kind of looking, that's the apodosis, and then the rest of it's going to be the apodosis. And you've already set up a pattern that helps. So you've got that moth yumath, at the end, again, this one. So, again, a participle, gonave ish, and then you're going to a u nakaro, you're going to a perfect that's now going to have, in effect, imperfect meaning. Because that starting with a participle was like starting with an imperfect. It was another category of that. And how did they word that? Nonverbal clauses. Let's call it a nonverbal clause, even a participle is technically a... It's a verbal adjective, and here it's acting like a noun almost. Well, it's not really acting like a noun in this context here, but they're treating it as nonverbal. I think you just defined it that way. Okay, any questions on that example? It says, these may also be translated non-conditionally as, anyone who slays shall be put to death, or anyone who does this shall be put to death, and so forth. But still, that's giving you, the form isn't conditional anymore, but the fact that you put anyone in there makes it hypothetical and conditional. You know, so in other words, that's just another mode in English of expressing that. So Hebrew isn't that far afield from English in that respect. We can make statements that are conditional, even though they're not put in a real obvious conditional mode. This is one thing that is important when you're doing logic analysis, to be able to discern the fact that you're dealing with a conditional, even if it doesn't say if then. In other words, in English, you may see sentences like this, anyone who slays shall be put to death. And if you're doing a logical analysis of something, you know, you would analyze this just like you would something else. If man slays, he should be put to death. Because to say anyone who slays is making it hypothetical, making the statement applicable to anybody who's in that condition, and what you indeed have done is made a conditional sentence out of it logically. Logically, the condition's still there. So that may be... No, Hebrew just may be more logically approaching it. You know, they just put it together and they see the relationship, and the rest of it is determined by context. It has to be conditional, can't be anything else. But it's conceptually conditional, not necessarily formally such. Okay. Conditional sentences marked by a special conjunction, if, are of two types. So we do have some that are marked also. So you don't have the ambiguities with these, perhaps. But number one, those introduced by im, hain, or ki, which are real, fulfilled, or fulfillable. Do we have hain before as a word? It means if. I don't know if we had it in the vocab list or maybe not. It's in the back of the book. It means if, just like im does. And ki, of course, we've already had. That's a good question. The difference is probably in the kind of clauses that they're used with, but they don't give any distinction in the book. You may want to check it and see if the lexicons give you any difference. They just put if for both of them. So, and here apparently both can be used in conditionals. So I don't know if you could see maybe one's used for more hypothetical ones. These though they're all falling into the category which are real, fulfilled, or fulfillable. And then the contrary to fact ones are introduced by lu. So you have another word lu that can be translated if, but it's when you're introducing unreal, contrary to fact, or unfulfillable things. And then there's lu lay, which is the negative form. So if you find any insight on that, it'd be interesting to see. Okay, let's look at these two types then. First, the type one, where you've got im, hain, or ki introducing it. The protasis, the if clause, may have a perfect, imperfect, or participial predicate. It is difficult to maintain these distinctions in translation. The perfect sometimes has the value of the English perfect, or perhaps overcorrectly of the future perfect, but more often takes on the value of the Hebrew imperfect in its general present future function. Thus, although one let me just stop to say something about this. First of all, he's saying that when you're dealing with a hypothetical situation, the perfect, even though you may see it in the perfect, imperfect, or a participial predicate, in other words, using participle, and we saw an example of that already earlier. If it is perfect in form, see, the imperfect is not too bad. You know, you can see that you're talking about either future things there, and the participle, maybe a progressive aspect. But in the perfect, you may often see it could take the value of the English perfect, where if you want to say, if he had done this, then this would not have happened. In other words, if you're talking about the Pratis as being an event that had occurred in the past or should have occurred in the past, you can translate into perfect. But sometimes, even if it's perfect in form, it's going to be translated imperfect because the context is showing that the action hasn't yet taken place. And the examples he give here, thus, although one may make a valid distinction between im matzati chen, if I have found favor, and im ensa chen, if I find favor in the future, that same distinction becomes artificial if applied to, for example, if you cross over with me, which you'll be a burden to me. He gives two examples here. If they cross over with you, you'll give them. In both cases, the meaning is talking about some historical event. And in the first example, a perfect form is used. In the second example, an imperfect form is used. And the strange, from context, you can't really apply any different sense to that, really. I suppose you might say, if you crossed over with me, you will be a burden to me. I think what may be happening with the perfect is that if you're talking about an event that is not yet happened, and you use a perfect for the if clause, what you're doing is you're kind of coming down after. How do I word this? Your frame of reference is projecting yourself into a future time at which time the prophecies will have already been fulfilled. It's not yet, but you're projecting yourself to the point when it has been. Just like we did with those narrative sequences and so forth, you kind of project yourself using perfects for something in the future. You're kind of projecting yourself into the future at which time you've seen it happen. I know I'm not quite expressing this the way it's in my mind here, but let me make one more attempt at it here. If you cross over in English, we might say that if you would have crossed over with me, you will be a burden to me, or if you will have crossed over with me, you will be a burden to me. In other words, if at some point in the future it will occur that you have crossed over with me, at that point that you have crossed over with me, you will be a burden to me. So so the perfect can still be seen as making some sense there, because at the time that you're a burden to me, you will have already crossed over. See what I'm saying? I don't know how else to word that, but in other words, we're trying to justify the use of a perfect verb form in a hypothetical situation or in a conditional situation, in a situation where it's clearly talking about the future. Now, in some cases, it may be already talking about a past thing, like the one above. If I have found favor, you would have already found favor, then something will follow from that, as opposed to if I find favor, which is not yet fulfilled. But in the next example here, you've got two situations that are both historical situations, and both of them are getting translated pretty much the same, even though one's got a perfect verb form and the other one's got an imperfect verb form. But the one with the perfect verb form can still be referring to a future event, if you crossed over with me, in the sense that the person who's saying it may be projecting himself to the point of saying, if it should come to pass that you have crossed over with me, you will be a burden to me. And he can still use that you have crossed over with me, even though it hasn't happened yet, but he's projecting to a point at which it would have happened, since it's a hypothetical statement anyway. Yes, right?
You're saying that when you see these clauses like this, that you're going to translate that whole sentence into a general future type.
Mm-hmm. But you do need to watch.
Take that perfect and you can.
Yeah, there's a way. I'm saying that, he's saying just translate a future and don't make any distinction between the perfect and the imperfect in these kinds of situations. Well, that's kind of the bottom line. That's the way you might translate it to give it the simplest expression in English. But what I'm trying to say is I'm looking deeper and I'm wanting to say, why are we really saying that perfect and imperfect don't make any difference here? I don't think we're saying that. I think that using the perfect is doing a certain kind of a time projection thing to you, where you're focusing on a certain kind of thing. It's an aspect difference. And it may not be worth quibbling about. It might be easiest to, the easy thing is just tell the student, don't worry about it, just make them the same. But I think that there is a reason for a difference there, and it's worth looking at. And it's more the view of where you're focusing on the action. And it's the same kind of thing that you see with the well consecutive series. Some authors say, well, you just convert the tense and just make it a mechanical, just switch, just translate them this way, and don't worry about it. I would rather have you try to think of why are they doing it that way. And the fact that they're using imperfects in to follow up a series that started out in the perfect, if we think of it as more of a translating you back in time to the events and seeing them happen and then using imperfects because it's happening at that time, I think it gives you a better insight into what's going on. Okay, I guess we're out of time.